So I want to start off with something that I noticed that that I'm curious if this is apparent or if this was a point you were doing. Is there a bit of Tarantino in this film with the chapters? There's even a reference, and then obviously I think with the over the top elements of violence, I'm curious if there's a little bit of a nod there.
First of all, just mentioning his name. No, this is a great compliment. The whole movie is really referential. I mean, absolutely, Tarantino is in there. To tell you the truth, I wrote it with a good friend of mine, Guy, but what sort of drove me to start this project was a good friend of mine passed away, and she was somebody I always used to go see movies with. We grew up together, and she was like my go-to friend whenever there was a film festival around or any screenings or anything like that. And she passed away, and I really wanted it was sort of in the back of my mind that if I'm going to make another movie, it's going to have all these sort of references to all these movies that we used to love. So absolutely Tarantino's in there, but it's like there's like big, like there's like sections that rip off from like a Almodovar. There's like a De Palma body double reference there with the underwear when Moa grabs it. There's what else is in there? There's like a Fight Club section where they're thinking about like getting rid of the evidence or whatever. That's like sort of like when they were trying to bury the body in the backyard. But anyway, yeah, there's a bunch of references there. Buñuel, of course, was like sort of like a conceptual sort of inspiration for this. So yes, absolutely, absolutely. Especially with the chapters and all the blood and over the top violence. Yeah.
So I've got to ask, you brought up Guy. Yes. He did the music on this. Can you talk a bit about how important the music choices are and how they kind of fit into the movie? I think there's moments where it's like, ah, you guys hit the music tone just perfectly.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. Some parts I feel like the music sort of serves or like goes hand in hand with like what you'd expect, and then there's like other parts of the movie where it's like it goes completely against sort of like the obvious choice. I think there's like one cue on the sixth reel, like sort of like the end of the movie, where it's like we knew we wanted to reference again like this sort of almost like a Soviet like military song, which is very sort of like, you know, early Zionist propaganda sound. And Guy is just, you know, he's so talented, and he was so invested in the story that I think he was just really enjoying going all over the place with this. So, yeah, it was a pleasure. It was like certain parts were easier to score than others. But definitely had a lot of fun with it.
So, as far as tone, one of the things I love about the movie is just how much fun I think you have making moments slightly comedic in a dark comedy way. But there are three lines. If you don't mind me, I'm gonna ask you to talk about these three specific things. I'll start with the chauffeur as a weapon, and I mean, there's so many great elements of weapons, and it kind of felt like Clue, like everyone kind of died a different way. Not to give too much spoilers, but I'm curious, how much fun was it to use something so important to the Jewish people in such a unique way?
So, you know what? It just seemed obvious. Like, I was actually at a dinner party. I mentioned it. I don't know if you were around for the Q&A that we did for the Austin Jewish Film Festival or not, but Rebecca, who did the Q&A, who's moderating it, actually also pointed out the shofar. And basically, I was at a house party, and they had the same sort of like big shofar hanging on the wall. And it always seemed to me like such a weird choice of placement, you know, almost like is it a piece of art? I mean, it's obviously Judaica, but, you know, but it just seemed to me like this is sort of, you know, it almost looks like a baseball bat, you know, it almost like asks, you know, to be grabbed and like waved around and as a weapon. So it was like, you know, we weren't even thinking. It was just, it was an obvious choice.
So the second point is, I think one of my favorite lines is when he's reading his text and it says, hashtag yummy yummy, and then I thought your audition was tomorrow. There's so much an allusion to Hollywood with that moment. How much fun was it to kind of poke fun at, you know, a little bit of what Hollywood is going? I mean, obviously the Me Too movement is one element of it, but I felt like that was a nice little touch of, you can ruin your career with the smallest of things. That's how fickle the community can be. And you do that in such a great way. Was that something that was always in the script as something as an idea?
I don't necessarily think. I mean, because when we started writing it, I don't know if the Me Too movement really hit big, but this idea of this really self-centered sort of like failing actor, whose sort of like primary concern is his career and what people are saying and, you know, whether he's going to get a part or not get a part, was always sort of like, we always knew that was one of the main characters that we wanted to have in this. And it's such a, I feel like any, you know, LA sort of like is a place that sort of draws a lot of artists and wannabe artists and actors. So we absolutely, placing this dinner in Los Angeles, like we knew one of the guys going to be the sort of like failed actor or struggling actor. But I got to tell you, with the hashtag, that's all guy in that sense. He was that, especially the hashtag yummy yummy was like something that he said, and we just cracked up and we knew it was going to end up in the script. But I think Michael Maloney had a great time with those. I'm not sure if we were like, I think we, if I remember correctly, we had a few more, and it was like, I wasn't sure, you know, every take he did, like, there were different ones, but I think the hashtag yummy yummy was always sort of like the first one, because it just seemed like so ridiculous, especially since, you know, we know what the image is, right? So it was like, it felt appropriate.
I like that it's Michael who plays the struggling actor. I think with his success, that seems so perfectly nestled for him. It's a great role for him. The third point, and I think this is my favorite scene in the movie, when the Seagal character is caught in the bathroom and she has to talk to her kids. Can you talk about creating that scene? And I think that's a drawback to the whole point of the movie, is that all this craziness is going on in a world that is very real, and these people's lives are now going to be completely messed up, but yet she just wants to make sure her kids are being okay. And that talking to the second child, how quick that is. I love that scene.
Yeah, you know what? It was like, it was always, I think it was, first of all, a challenge having, I'm sort of going to sort of answer, hopefully answer what you're asking, or comment about what you're asking. But basically there was like, we had like 9 or 10 actors on set at different points. And each one of them is super talented. Some of them have like comedy experience, and others have like no comedy experience. You know, the people like you know, Iris Barr, for example, who played Hidla. She's hilarious. She's a comedian. She does stand up comedy. She was on Curb Your Enthusiasm. She brings, you know, one type of comedy to this. And Liraz Khamani, who played Seagal, I mean, she's not a comedian, but she has such great comic timing. But she has, like, you know, it's a different type of sort of comedy. So just getting everybody, all the different actors, to sort of play the same tune, or sort of like, sort of just be, you know, together and do this in a way that plays off each other, and it never feels like one of them is not part of the reality of the movie in a way. Was a little bit of a challenge, but I felt like the actors sort of really gelled well together and really got along together well in terms of like their work, and sort of any sort of like discrepancies or sort of like differences in their comedy were sort of solved on their own pretty quickly. But one of the main things, like talking to the actors and talking about these characters and the reality of the situation, is that they should always play this as if this is genuine and real for these characters. Mm. So when Seagal answers the phone in the middle of this, you know, chase scene where this, you know, crazy man is trying to butcher her, because, you know, she picks up the phone because it's one of her kids, right? And she tries to keep this calm. It felt like it needed to have, I mean, it's definitely one of the most absurd sort of moments in the movie, but to her, that was, you know, to the character, I was like, you have to play this straight. Like, this is like of utter importance at this point, where these kids are like, you know, for them, this is like a big deal. So you have to take this call, you have to answer it, and have to sort of play in the most realistic sort of way. I have to say that this was like, we shot this really towards the end of the shoot. And she had to run in those high heels. Mm. And it was like 18 days straight of like running around in high heels. And she was almost in tears at the end of that scene. Like, we had to reshoot it, I think. Like, there was like two shots that we had to sort of pick up later. And when she heard we were going to do that scene again, she was, you know, she was ready to kill me. But yeah, it was, it took a lot out of her. But I think it's a great moment. It cracks me up every time I see it.
I immediately cracked up. I was like, that's pretty genius. Speaking of time, and location, is it one house? Is it, also you said 18 days, was that the full shoot or how long did you shoot? I'd love to know the,
we shot for 17 days and the 18th day was like a half day that we stole. I think one of the Saturdays, cause the only time we could get the kids available, was on a weekend.
Wow.
Born in school. So we shot for like 17 and a half days, I guess. And yes, that was one location, one house, which took us a long time to find because, of course, we didn't have a huge budget, right? So we couldn't build any sets or not even get any of those like multiple sort of like, oh, let's shoot this part outside, you know, this house, you know, just the exteriors and then move for the, you know, to another location for the inside. We couldn't afford that in terms of like time, you know, company moves. So we had to sort of find one house that would serve all our purposes. So of course there were some adjustments and some scenes that should have played in the backyard, but didn't, but ended up moving indoors, all those kind of things. So we definitely had to do some adjustments. But everything in a way happened in like one location. Actually, like shooting it was one house.
Wow. Can you talk about then the types of setups and your DP, Ziv, how do you guys shot certain sequences? Because there's a lot, like you said, there's a chase sequence, there's a lot of movement throughout this house. Can you talk a bit about setting up these shots? I mean, it looked fluid.
Well, first of all, thank you. Second of all, Ziv is absolutely an amazing DP. And I think the movie owes him a lot. I owe him a lot. So I'm really glad that sort of comes across when you watch this. So first of all, in terms of the way we sort of thought about the movie is like, we knew we couldn't shoot it on one hand, like a real sort of like Hollywood film, right? Like a big budget movie with really, you know, insane coverage or sort of like big camera moves and all that. But we also sort of didn't want to because it was, there's like, the movie's kind of weird. You know, there's like, it mixes genres, and we felt the camera should sort of play to that. And the way we sort of thought about it conceptually is like, the camera doesn't actually move at all up until the end of the first act. So until the dinner table, sort of like when Avner gets up and tells Michael, you know, shut your mouth or I'm going to shut it for you, or something of the sort. That's the first sort of camera move in the entire movie. So up until that point, everything that you're seeing is like static. And then as the action sort of like, as the movie sort of picks up steam, we have more camera moves, and also, you know, quicker editing, more music. It sort of like goes to more sort of, you know, standard tropes of like the genre. But the other thing that we also wanted to do is earlier in the movie, you have no singles. So nobody is actually, none of this, you know, none of the guests are like alone in a frame at any time. So it's either over the shoulders or group shots, two shots. Like you never have just one person. You never have singles. So even at the dinner table, when we're sort of like in a close up on Michael, we'll see sort of like the back of Aaliyah, or we'll see somebody else in the frame. So at no point, like we get, basically grouping them together, keeping them together as a unit. So even if it's not noticeable, at least in terms of like the framing and the camera, they're a group, if it makes sense. And as sort of like the violence takes over, we're separating them. And we're seeing more and more sort of like close up and more singles, where it's like you only see one character in the frame. But that really, I mean, people also die off, so you have less and less people to fill the frame. But the idea is that, as you know, it's static and it's group shots in the beginning, and as the movie progresses, it's singles and more camera moves. And we also wanted camera moves to be very sort of fluid and very, very, you know, minimal. The camera never sort of like goes crazy with the violence. One of the things that I also kind of liked is to let the violence play sort of like in front of the camera, not rely so much on editing, which again is kind of tough when you're doing a low budget film, but especially in the beginning at the dinner table, like we sort of left the cameras sort of almost like watching the action as opposed to cutting in there. And it's not until later in the movie that we get closer to the violence and we get in the space of the actors. The other thing that Ziv felt was really important, even though, like I mentioned, like Almodovar is one of the sort of like, the influences that this movie has, especially in the female characters and the way, you know, Yaz plays Seagal and all that. And like I said, the moments that are sort of ripped off of Voltaire. but we definitely wanted these frames that have a lot of production design. There's a lot of sort of artifacts in the house, in the background. But unlike Almodovar, Ziv made it a point to not have anything red in the frame. So there is no color red in this movie except for the blood. The closest thing is sort of like Liraz's, Seagal's dress, which is like this dark burgundy thing. But that's sort of like the closest thing that we have to a red. But the only red color in the movie is the blood, which is kind of interesting, and I really liked that idea when he brought it up. So anyway, I'm sorry, I'm digressing.
Well, no, I'm gonna make you talk more about that, because my next question is, talk to me about your blood formula and the fact that there is so much of it. For a low-budget film, I was amazed at how much you have, and I especially love the chunky blood that you had in it. I think people who like horror films would look at this and be like, these guys did this right somehow. Talk to me about working with blood.
Wow, okay, so I have no idea what our formula was. I should have... If you had sent me that question ahead of time, I would have called our amazing makeup artist, Monique, and asked her what her formula was for the blood. And I'm so happy you say you think there's a lot of it, because I feel like we should have had so much. Part of me feels that, you know, I should have had so much more blood, blood in this movie. The biggest sort of concern is really continuity. I read somewhere, I watched somewhere that, Fincher shoots, he uses all digital blood. He adds all the blood in post because he doesn't want to sort of deal with, like, you know, resetting these scenes with too much blood or continuity. And I got to tell you, when you're trying to spray a bunch of blood on a wall or in the kitchen or without revealing too many, without spoiling too much, and then having to do multiple takes, it takes a long time to wipe all the blood, clean the actors, showers, put a load of laundry in, put them in a new costume. Basically, it's like there's only sort of like a certain amount of time that you're allowed to sort of spend on this. So the fact that you feel that this is well done is really sort of like kudos to our production and to our professional team, the costume designer and the makeup artist and, set dresser, everybody that did an amazing job, because I felt like we had maybe two or three takes for some of the bloodier parts. So they really stepped up and pulled it off.
You do, it's there, and I know I loved it. I love the fact that there's different types of, like you said, there's splatter. There's, of course, when the Seagal character has the bleed out at the end. I love the darkness of that blood compared to the other bloods. I was like, if that's what you're saying, it was just your production person, make sure you keep her along, because that, it looked great.
We love sort of like, definitely that sort of blood, I wanted it to look sort of thicker and move slower in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't know if realistically it makes sense. But especially since, like, before, a little bit before that, there's some brain matter that flies around, like chunks and stuff like that. So I really wanted that to be sort of sticky and slow and thicker. So, because we stay so long on her face in a way, but I don't know if we're spoiling stuff, but yeah, it was definitely a lot of fun. It was definitely a lot of fun. And just remember, one of the showers in the home had a sign on it that said, "Bloody actress, shower here." So there was one specific shower that we were allowed to sort of use to wash the blood off. And obviously, it was fairly pink at the end of the shoot. But,
So I've got to ask, Michael, you brought up the Q&A. Can you talk a bit about the craziness of the film festival world this year, because I know you have traveled very well with your films. I mean, Out in the Dark, you were all over the place with that wonderful film. And this one, you also have been to numerous film festivals. But can you touch upon COVID kind of completely changing the film festival game? I mean, it may never recover to some extent. I mean, for us here in Texas, I mean, we lost South By. It was terrible. But can you touch upon film festivals and the importance of them and how maybe Zoom and these new ways of doing it are different, but at least there's you're still able to have a film showcased here in Austin and outside of, I mean, you've shown this all over the world. So I'm curious your thoughts on film festivals.
So first of all, it's one of those things where it's like, earlier today, I was talking to somebody over lunch about the fact that, we've had a few film festivals that got canceled. We had a few invitations, like the movie played in Istanbul earlier in the year. And I was invited. Michael Maloney was invited. Samami was invited. And the festival ended up moving virtually. And, just this sort of like complaining about like, oh, I didn't go to, I didn't get to go to Istanbul or something like that. And then I realized I know multiple people that started shooting and ended up like pulling the plug on a production halfway through because of COVID. Mm. In a way, I think we're very lucky that we have a movie. We have a movie that started its run before everything sort of happened. So we have a movie that is playing in festivals and is finding an audience in this sort of weird world we're in right now. So I'm definitely thankful and I definitely feel lucky in that sense. But at the same time, yeah, it kind of sucks. I mean, your presence in, at the Austin Film Festival every year, right?
Oh yeah.
You're really involved with them. And I know that you were, Did you have your own festival for a while? Is that correct, or were you running a festival in Dallas? Or I'm not sure.
Yeah, we were the interview team for Dallas International for the last 4 years, and yeah, I mean,
right. So you know, probably better than I do, the vibe, the energy, the sort of the meeting of talents, of creative people. It's like as wonderful as like the virtual experiences. And, you know, the ease of sort of like doing those Zoom things or you know, being able to sort of stream a brand new film or like a small indie in your own living room, sort of like in a world premiere is exciting, but nothing is as wonderful, as exciting, as intense as a film festival environment, I think. A real sort of physical film festival. So I definitely hope that we're going to sort of like get to experience that either with my next film or, you know what I'm saying? Like I definitely hope that we're getting back to some sense of normalcy, at some point, but yeah, it's been interesting virtually. It's definitely been interesting. And, yeah, I don't know. Did I answer your question? I'm not even sure if I answered your question, but
you definitely did, because I think okay. I think it's a subject that obviously can't be answered fully right now because we don't know where we're going. And like you said, there is it's nice to yes have Zoom and have the accessibility online, but there is nothing like being able to have a Q&A in person, to have a film in the theater with the people, and for my side, being able to be behind the scenes and talk to the talent one-on-one. I mean, we would have been doing this interview as a sit down in person and it would have been completely different. You know what I mean? So.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen, just the amount of people that you meet, you know, even if it's like over drinks at a festival, you know, it's like, it's really difficult to replace that sort of experience. Mm. And the other thing is like, as a filmmaker, you don't get to really interact with audiences. I mean, if you're lucky enough to have your movie play in theaters, and for example, Out in the Dark played here in the U.S. in a bunch of theaters and in other countries as well. I didn't get to, I think I attended one screening here in L.A., actual like a theatrical screening. So going to a film festival is the only time as a filmmaker that you have a chance to actually interact with your audience.
Mm.
Outside of social media, or you know what I'm saying? Like actually meet. So, you know, it's not like doing theater or and I guess other artists. I mean, if you're a painter or whatever, your painting is hanging in a museum or whatever it is, again, you're don't really get the chance to interact with an audience. So those rare opportunities that you have at a film festival are amazing. They're super interesting and really satisfying, really fulfilling to sort of meet audiences and interact with them.
So kind of last question, Michael, I'd love to know, there's so much difference in subject, in tone between Out in the Dark and this, as far as your next project and what you have in mind or maybe what you're searching to look for. Have you figured out what you're shooting next and will it be something, completely different? I like the fact that you're taking different types of leaps of faith, and it's showing on screen.
To be completely honest, I hope the next one is not too similar to either. I feel like I still want to experiment. Like I said, this movie was so referential and had so many sort of elements and tones in it, a mixture of tones that I felt was something that I needed to get out of my system in a way. Like, oh, I always wanted to, you know, make a movie with a dance scene in it, right? Or something like that, or somebody like, you know, wielding a shofar. So I did that. But yeah, I think I'm writing something now that is neither Out in the Dark nor nor Happy Times. So yeah, we'll see. Even though somebody mentioned, like, I'm always surprised when people sort of come up and mention like similarities between the movies. The other day actually Rebecca during the Q&A at the Austin Jewish Film Festival, she mentioned sort of like the idea of love and the power of love, that in a way there's an attempt of that at the end of Happy Times. Sort of like there's sort of like a glimpse at, like, you know, love and whether love will be able to sort of heal everything, and that relates to Out in the Dark in a way. So I don't know, I mean, people, like, I've heard people find similarities between the movies, which I'm always surprised when they do, but hey, why not?
Well, Michael, it's been a pleasure. Love the film, love the title, and I think keep doing what you're doing, and yeah, can't wait to see the next one, buddy. Thanks so much.
No, thank you, and you too. Keep doing what you're doing. Thank you for checking out your interview.